Hello, and welcome to the Slongcast episode 5 for May 31st, 2010. I'm your host, Kevin Slonka, and for the first time ever, I have a guest with me in the studio. Say hello to Ryan Lancey for me.
Hey everyone, how are you? This is Ryan.
Okay, so we got actually a lot of stuff to talk about. I picked way too many topics, so we'll see if we can get through them in any amount of time. So first thing I wanted to talk about, the first two were actually articles that I wrote and put on my website within the past couple weeks, but I wanted to get Ryan's idea on some of them. So first one being the article I wrote on having internet in your car. So pretty much for me, you know, I listen to a lot of the Twitch shows. Do you listen to any of the Twitch shows?
I do listen to a few. It's been a while since I haven't listened to any episodes, probably in a couple months. But
you know that they do them live now, right? You can stream the live broadcast?
Yeah, I've seen that.
So I've been doing that on my phone since they made it HTML5. You can do it on your iPhone now. You don't have an iPhone, so you don't have that problem. No, but I always have the problem. I can never stream anything live. So I've been listening to it in my car, plug it into my FM transmitter, and as I'm driving, listen to the live shows. And that's kind of annoying because I got to plug stuff in and hit the right FM station. And if I drive from city to city, the FM stations overlap and I got to pick a new station. It's horrible. So I just wrote an article saying, why don't we have internet in our car? You know, we have OnStar, so that connects to the internet for people to do that. All I want is my radio, you know, be able to set some presets and be able to press a button, because most cars come with a big, you know, 6-inch or 4-inch panel, and go twit and have it start playing so I don't have to use my phone.
Well, I think it's interesting that you talk about having internet in your car, but, you know, we have several types of technologies that can enable you to access the internet through your phone with your car, such as Bluetooth.
Right.
And so I think there's a new wireless USB standard that's soon to come out. And in fact, the newest car that I recently purchased has a Bluetooth-enabled headset.
What kind of car is that again?
It's a Kia Forte Coupe.
Okay.
The Bluetooth feature is really nice. Now, it doesn't go as far as enabling internet, but that's something that could be done. There's a lot of phones that support tethering over Bluetooth.
Right.
So I think I'm a little adverse to having yet another internet service to pay for, one that would be strictly limited to your car.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, if you have OnStar, I guess you're paying for that anyways after the first free year runs out. But yeah, if you have to pay, because, I mean, what's it going to have to use? 3G. You know, right. So you're going to have to pay $30 a month for that.
I think what we'd all benefit from would be some better standards to interface with our phones, like an open standard, so that, you know, even things like OnStar could be provided via our phone service rather than, you know, having to have another bill and yet another cell phone device in the car that,
right.
you know, you may not use if you don't want OnStar, but yet if it had a feature to, you know, pair with your phone, you could use that feature.
Right, and that would fix one of the problems that I have, which is another cable plugging into my phone. I hate plugging in the cable when I get in the car. So if it had Bluetooth, that would be great. But on the other hand, Bluetooth is kind of a battery drain on most of today's phones, so doing that for long distances,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's still... Yeah, we need something different.
Yeah.
I don't think Bluetooth is the answer. I think it's better than what I have. But, you know, you have Bluetooth in your car, so that's way better.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely a time saver. I think it definitely has reduced my distraction on the road. So I think, you know, Bluetooth-enabled devices are better than other non-hands-free types. But to provide the internet services, yeah, it may not be robust enough. And I think, as exampled in a recent, I believe it was the Google keynote at Google I.O., you know, the Bluetooth signals, when there's a lot of Bluetooth signals in a room, it can cause a lot of problems. And I think on a highway in traffic, if everybody has a Bluetooth-enabled car, we may have some problems.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to make cars their own Faraday cages pretty much. I mean, how bad would that suck if somebody drives up next to you that has Bluetooth-enabled and all of a sudden your phones pair with the wrong cars?
Yeah.
You know, that would be horrible.
Yep.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't have Bluetooth in my car. My car's 5 years old. So I have to make do with the FM transmitter.
I recommend you buy a new one.
But it works. I don't need a new one yet. I'll keep it till it falls apart. But yeah, I really just wish we would have some way of having internet in our car. Because even the Bluetooth or some way of having your phone do it isn't a nice step forward. I don't want my phone to have anything to do with it. You know, I don't know. I don't use hands-free that much. I've ridden with a friend of mine. Do you know Frank Cameron?
I do know Frank. Well, I don't know him personally, but I know of him.
You know of him. So his car has Bluetooth, and he got it a couple years ago, and we paired my iPhone to it, and he was making calls with it, whatever. And that's cool. I don't know. I just I don't know. I'm just one of those people. I don't know. But the one thing that I don't like, which I really wanted to bring up with the internet in the cars, is hacking it. So I don't know if you read the article or heard about it, but people have found a way to hack the computers that OnStar controls in the cars to basically, you know, cut brakes, you know, turn off the car or whatever. They can't do it remotely yet, so it's not wireless. They had to have the plug-in to that console underneath the wheel, the steering wheel.
Yeah, that'd be the ODB2 port.
Yeah, so they had to have a connection to that, but then they were able to connect to the 7 or 9, whatever. There's a ton of computer modules in there that control all the parts of the car, and they were able to, you know, shut down systems in the car. So it's only a matter of time till they take that from hardwired to wireless and do it the same way the OnStar people do to, you know, unlock your car or shut off the engine if somebody steals your car.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it just depends on what OnStar has made public in their API, or not public, but exposed in the API,
right,
via the cell interface. I doubt that, you know, they probably could shut down electronic brake systems such as, like, you know, ABS and anything like that, and maybe muck with something like, you know, the Prius. It has, I think, an electronic braking system. But most of those brakes have, those brake systems have a fallback mode using hydraulics, and I don't think that they would be able to completely disable the braking function.
Right. Enough to probably scare the crap out of you and
maybe
make you swerve.
Not much different from a Toyota Camry.
Burn. Okay, so that's enough on that one. The second thing I wanted to talk about, have you seen any 3D movies?
The most recent 3D movie I saw was at the Baltimore Aquarium. They have I don't know if it's an IMAX or an OmniMax or one of those.
Was it a silver screen, though? Like, could you tell that it was silver?
No, I don't remember. I don't recall that. It did use the polarized glasses, the polarized, if that helps you narrow it down.
So they weren't the active glasses. Like, they didn't have batteries.
No.
It was just, like, cheapo.
Yeah, cheapo plastic polarized lenses, I believe, is what they used.
Yeah, so it had to have been a silver type-ish screen, then.
Okay.
That's what the IMAX uses.
Okay.
Yeah, so I first saw one. I was down in Florida, went to see How to Train Your Dragon in IMAX 3D. If you haven't seen that, awesome. Go see it. Great movie. Not just a kid's movie.
Noted.
But, yes. But that was an awesome experience. I sat about 40% away from the screen, so that whenever I put on the glasses and I looked at the screen, since it was IMAX, it was huge, completely filled my peripheral vision. That's all I could see was the screen. And when this thing came on, I mean, the whole movie was made for 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it wasn't an afterthought, and it was amazing. Like, it was like I was in the film and stuff was just happening around me.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people think, you know, 3D, oh, it's the red and blue, you know, going to have a stupid ball bounce at your face and it's going to be crap. But, you know, it's not a gimmick anymore.
No, I mean, the one I've seen, you know, that was in the Baltimore Aquarium, it was impressive. It was also something that I think they called it a 4D theater because it used sound, or, well, not sound effects, but pneumatics, like air, water, and other types, and like shaking to, like, you know, bring the audience even further into the movie experience. And that helped, I think, with that movie in particular, because it was about undersea creatures and that sort of thing. It's definitely impressive. I think in a theater setting, it's something that, you know, may become more mainstream. It's, you know, in a theater, you're typically sitting in a seat. Because of the specialized equipment, it's, you know, it's going to cost a lot of money, but theaters are typically expensive anyways. They have expensive equipment.
I'm sure they make plenty of money to cover those costs.
Yeah, well, and I mean, they're charging a lot more for these 3D movies. I actually saw an article this morning, or a piece this morning on the Today Show. And I think they were saying something that some of these 3D movies in New York are $20 to get in.
It was $17 for the one that I went to
see. Yeah, so to take a whole family of four, I think that's a little bit expensive. But, you know, nonetheless, if it becomes more mainstream, the technology costs may come down. It may be something that is a little more interesting. In the home, however, I'm skeptical.
I am too. I don't know what it's going to be in the home because you're not going to have a silver screen, you know. There are basically two types of 3D that are out now. There's the silver screen kind where you have those regular polarized cheapo glasses, And then there's the Dolby-ish kind where you have like battery power glasses that try to split up the channels. And from what I read, those ones really screw with your eyes. And they, if you watch that for a long time, it will actually hurt your vision. Wow. Watching the act of type 3D. Nope.
That's not good.
Yeah, that's horrible. Yeah. And I mean, what other choice do you have in the home? Nobody's going to paint a silver screen to get the good type of 3D.
Yeah.
So your real only choice is the
active 3D.
Yeah, the kind that hurts
and
your eyes.
And I guess that's what most of these new TVs that came out this year, were announced this year.
Yeah. Mm. There's one TV, I don't know what company makes it, but one company is saying that their 3D, you don't need glasses. I don't know how that works, but...
Well, I think there's a couple companies that have found a way to put a polarized screen or some kind of screen, polarized glass on the screen itself. As the last thing before, you know, what you see. So, you know, you have your projection device or your, you know, lighting device behind that and some kind of color plane in front of it, and then this glass that's polarized. And that's what allows the 3D effect to happen to your eyes. However, it only works from on axis, you know.
Right, straight on.
Straight on in front of the TV. Yeah. The effect is much diminished from the sides. So I think Molly Wood of CNET, she put it best. I think that, you know, she doesn't foresee anyone coming over to her house and having a pile of these glasses for people to wear.
And they're expensive too. Did you see the cost of them? Like $150 for extra pairs.
Wow. Yes, that's something. I don't think that would be something that I would pay in addition. You know, just so like my friends could enjoy once in a while.
Right.
And then. I guess, on the other hand, they could bring their own glasses over if they had them. But that said, a lot of the time when I'm watching TV, I'm on a couch and I'm laying on my side. And I know I'm a contact wearer and eyeglasses, and I hate it when my eyeglasses shift off my face from laying on my side. And I think the same would happen with a pair of 3D glasses.
3D contacts. See, that's the answer to everything. Yeah, so I don't think they're going to... I don't know. Maybe somebody's going to come along and make something awesome for the home. But for right now, the stuff that's out there, I mean, I would say don't buy it. But Robert Herron, I don't know if you have seen any of his work, but he reviews HD equipment and stuff. He's on Techzilla, or not Techzilla, HD Nation on Revision 3. And that's like his job is to review this stuff. And he says that even though you're not going to use the 3D aspect of these TVs, today's 3D TVs are the best 2D TVs out there.
Mm.
So... You might not use 3D, but buy them because they're the best TVs for normal content, too.
Right. Well, much like your current car that's 5 years old, my LCD TV is a few years old, and it's got a great picture, so I don't foresee buying anything new for a while.
Exactly. I mean, I have a Sony Bravia XBR2. I think they're up to, like, XBR 200 now. I don't know. Whatever it is, though, my TV is old, and it works fine.
Yeah.
Not going to upgrade.
Yep.
All right, so moving on. Two stories about one of the companies that I really hate, and that is AT&T.
Oh, doesn't everyone hate AT&T?
Oh, they're horrible. Seriously. Anyways, though. So everybody who has AT&T and has gone to a big city knows how bad they suck. Because you go to big cities, everybody has iPhones, so their 3G network is just swamped. You know, it's either dirt slow or you get drop calls, doesn't work, whatever. So AT&T came up with this idea recently. They're going to blanket New York City with Wi-Fi in the hopes that everybody with an iPhone will just leave their Wi-Fi turned on as they're in walking around New York, use that for all of their data to alleviate the 3G network. What do you think of that?
Well, if the Wi-Fi network's properly managed, I can see it helping to, you know, spread out that load. And anything to help spread the load out would probably help download speeds. And I think the worst part isn't even the download speeds. It's the number of connections that it can support simultaneously.
Right. The towers can only support so many.
Yeah. And there's only so much they can do. I mean, we got to give the AT&T engineers a little slack. What they're doing is a pretty arduous task. They're trying to fit a lot of towers into a small urban space. And there's all kind of interference problems with RF. It's, you know, I'm not an expert in RF, but... I'm sure that's a challenging task. That said, when you sell a service, you got to live up to the terms of the contract on both ends, and I think that AT&T hasn't done that for the longest time. So maybe this Wi-Fi plan will work. I could see a 54G network getting bogged down pretty quickly itself, though.
Right.
And as everyone knows, you know, even point-to-point, 54G network will typically only yield about 20 megabits of bandwidth, if you're lucky, in a dense environment.
Yeah, so. I think even in my house, I tried to stream video, I get 21.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
You know, that's in my house. Imagine out in the big city.
Yeah, with a you know 200 and change simultaneous connections on an access point, it's going to be split up even worse. And the biggest problem with with wireless is latency. And when you have that many connections, you have to keep the to do a keep alive on. It's gonna cut into the bandwidth.
Yeah, I think this was a great out of the box idea by AT&T to think, you know, their biggest problem is data, so let's put in a data-only network. But on the other hand, you know, you were saying AT&T hasn't lived up to their promise, which they haven't, but I just want to throw the ball in the other court. I don't think anybody could have. You know, whatever company got the iPhone or whichever phone would have been the first awesome smartphone, that company would have seen the same problems. AT&T just happened to be the one, you know, that got the phone and got slammed. I think Verizon would have had the exact same problems. So as much as I hate AT&T, you got to give them some credit.
Well, yeah, like I said, I think that the problem that they're trying to solve is a big one. That said, there are other, you know, wireless technologies that support better concurrency. And I do believe that CDMA, which is what Verizon uses, is a little better at maintaining multitudes of simultaneous connections. But that said, who knows how it would have played out. It could be that AT&T is, you know, 120 or 150% beyond capacity, and maybe a CDMA network would be at 110, so it still wouldn't be that great.
Right.
You know, it's hard to know. I think the real answer, though, is that, you know, we have a lot of new wireless technologies coming out. You know, we already have 802.11n, which is a good bit faster than G. So, you know, maybe the next iPhone will have an N chipset in it. They might deploy an N network, and this might work out great for them. The other thing is you have HSPDA Plus. I think that they're I don't know if they have completely deployed it to New York, but that promises, I think, what, 7.2 megabits down.
Yeah, 7.2.
I don't know that that'll help with the connection concurrency, but then obviously there's the 4G solution. Once the 4G networks start to roll out, I'm sure that they're thinking about these problems and as they've been going. If they haven't, it'll be a travesty, really.
Yeah, AT&T will definitely go under if they haven't been thinking about that. As far as 4G is concerned, I know you know about LTE. You know, mm-hmm. That's what Verizon's using. What other companies were?
I believe all of the major carriers in the United States, T-Mobile, AT&T, Verizon, the former Alltel network, well, I think, which ended up getting bought by Verizon, and a couple others, all are into LTE or signed up early. In fact, the consortium that backed CDMA backs LTE now, from the best that I can tell. I'm not in the loop on everything, but from my research, that seems to be the case. And even Qualcomm, the largest producer of CDMA chipsets, I believe, in the world, has signed on to LTE. So the only loner out there is Sprint, which adopted an early technology called WiMAX, which there's a lot of debate whether it's even a 4G technology. It's definitely a wide area type Wi-Fi. But that said, I think the CEO of Sprint has been quoted saying that, hey, it's not a mutually exclusive problem here. We can support LTE and support WiMAX.
Right.
And I think their intent is to use WiMAX for some of the really heavy broadband devices and to use LTE moving forward with their phones. So,
yeah, that's something I'm hoping AT&T jumps on rather quickly because, you know, Verizon's already been implementing LTE, their 4G. Everybody else pretty much has been. AT&T, I forget what they said. Either they just started. They, whatever it is, they don't plan on having it out until next year sometime, like middle end of next year for their 4G network. That's, I don't know. I think that's horrible because, you know, they have the most popular phone on their network, and they will be the last carrier to get a high-speed 4G network. You know, I don't know whether they plan to do that or whether they just suck.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of investment that goes into upgrading a network like that. And I think to get any use out of it is going to require that the phones have 4G support, obviously. There's a lot of speculation that the iPhone that's going to be released, well, possibly released this summer, may be a 4G phone. That said, you know, we don't know for sure, and even if it is, you know, it may be the only phone that supports 4G. I don't know any other phones that are touted to support 4G on AT&T's network. But, you know, the other carriers are going to be in the same boat. They could spend, you know, billions of dollars, well, maybe not billions, but several millions of dollars at least, hundreds of millions, to upgrade their network. And if none of the phones take advantage of it, no one's gonna care, you know.
I think that's the big thing, too. You know, we care because we know, but what about, you know, our parents or our cousins or relatives? They're not going to have a clue that their phone is doing 4G. They don't care what speed it is. They just want it to work. So, yeah, I mean, it's a big deal for us because we use our phones heavily, but most people?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of it may come down to a lot of better planning. You know, I think for AT&T and Verizon, the challenge for them will be to get people to migrate to these new technologies, especially if the technologies better handle concurrency with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of connections on one tower, or thousands. I don't know what the capacity is, but something better than it is now.
Right.
So if they can't entice them to that, you know, it's going to be a hard sell. So
yeah, I think that's going to be easy for like New York, San Francisco to entice people to these things, but around here where people don't have these problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, my parents, their contract's up for a new phone. I'm trying to get them to get the Droid Incredible because they're on Verizon. They want to stay on Verizon. But they don't want to pay that extra $30 a month per phone for internet. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't want their phones to be able to do all this crap. They just want to make calls and sometimes text messages.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people in non-metropolitan places have the same feelings.
Yeah, well, this is a place where I think Sprint is really shining, is in the price of their contracts.
Yeah, they do have the best.
Yeah, I think an unlimited internet, text, and phone, unlimited phone, I think, you know, as many minutes as you can use, is $69 now.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I wouldn't quote me on that. I know at least one of their unlimited plans is $69, but I believe it's the one that's all three, and to me, that's groundbreaking.
I wish I could have that.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's like, well, if the coverage is good enough, it's almost worth, you know, maybe trying to switch.
Right.
But, you know, Sprint's got a really bad reputation. I was with Sprint several years ago when they bought Nextel. I was a Nextel customer. And they really threw the baby out with the bathwater, I think, with that. They didn't know what to do, I think, in the merger, and it really hurt them. And now I know for myself, I would be very adverse to jumping to somebody like Sprint, even though the pricing is attractive. So,
yeah, I mean, my iPhone bill, it's like $90 a month, and I have the lowest minute plan. I have the second lowest text message plan. You know, what am I paying for? This is ridiculous. Yeah.
Well, I guess you could be glad that you're not living in New York or San Francisco.
That's true, where it wouldn't work at all.
Exactly.
$100 to not have a phone work.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I saw that AT&T did is they just about doubled their early termination fee. It used to be like $175. It is now $325 if you end your AT&T contract before your 2 years is up.
Now, is this are they grandfathering existing contracts at $175, or is this just a new contract thing?
I do not know.
Okay.
The article I read did not say that, so I can't answer that.
My guess is this is just a reaction to what Verizon did. I don't know if anyone else is familiar. Verizon changed their terms of service about, I'd say 6 months ago, about the time the Droid Aris and the regular Droid came out.
The Motorola one.
The Motorola Droid came out on Verizon. And I believe for their smartphone or advanced technology devices or something that they called them to that name, something like that. They doubled it to $350.
And that is something I should point out. This early term fee is for smartphones. It's not for crap phones.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, part of me says, wow, that's a big price increase. The other part of me says, well, you know, they got to do what they got to do to keep their margins up. So, you know, I'm not a completely anti-business person, but I think, you know, in some ways, maybe some of this stuff's a little too cheap. I know a lot of people might find that hard to hear, but look at the problems in New York and San Francisco. The technology maybe isn't quite there yet. Maybe the pricing model was a little too low. It attracted too many customers. And if it were a little higher, we might not have these problems. You right. know, maybe a 5 or 10% reduction in this in sales might have led to a freer flowing network. They could have, you know, they could have done a lot of things. They could have put a more full-featured touch-enabled iPhone, or I'm sorry, touch-enabled iPod out there that had the camera and some of the other features that the phone had.
Right.
That was strictly Wi-Fi.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't need the iPhone. They get it for those features that the iPod Touch doesn't have.
Right. I would consider, like myself, I'm an iPod owner. I have a an older one. It's like the classic, I believe, with the hard drive in it. I would consider buying a touch-enabled iPod if it had the camera. I think that's the one big feature that it's missing right now.
And the funny thing is, the iPod Mini, the thing that's like an inch wide, has a camera.
Yeah, completely. Come on. I mean, well, I believe it's only, is it only a video camera or is it both still and video? I think it's only video.
I don't know. But either way, just to have a camera on something that small without a screen?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Well, I recall, it brings up memories of some comedian at one time that, you know, discussed how small these phones are getting, and at some point it's going to be like, oh, I hear my phone ringing, but I can't find it.
Zoolander.
Yeah, is that? Yeah, maybe that might be one of the references. So, I mean, I think in some ways these devices are just becoming too tiny, too integrated to do anything useful with. And a camera on the iPod Nano is a perfect example. But in the case of the iTouch or the iPod Touch, it's definitely, I think, lacking there.
Yeah. Okay, so enough beating up on AT&T. Everybody does that enough. I just had to get my words on it. So next thing is another company that lots of people hate. I should clarify, lots of people in the tech industry hate, but most normal people don't even know what's going on. And that is Facebook. So everybody has seen within the past year all of the privacy changes. You know, pretty much every other time you log into Facebook, you get a pop-up. Hey, our privacy controls changed. Let us show you what to do. Step one, step two, step three, fix this. And then all of a sudden you find out, oh, all of my information is public and everybody in the world can see my stuff. So Facebook has done this 3 or 4 times. Every time they do it, they make stuff more and more public. While they say they tell you we're going to do this, but nobody can understand the language that they use. So Mark Zuckerberg, last week put out an article in the Washington Post, I believe, was the paper, and it was kind of his apology to all of the privacy trouble they've been having. He never really apologized. It was just his explanation as to what they've been doing. And the thing about it is, he still thinks they're right. He still thinks they're moving in a way where they're making a more open and connected internet that's going to make a better world. And there are two quotes that I wanted to read, which I find ridiculous. So the one thing that he says is, "The biggest message we have heard recently is that people want easier control over their information." No! The biggest thing you've heard recently is people are complaining because all of their information is public and you're hiding things from them. You're not telling them what you're doing. I mean, what do you think about that, Ryan?
Well, as far as the privacy goes, I mean, I think definitely people do want control over their privacy. I think you're right, and it's a finer point that it's really not that they want easier control. It's they want to know what is shared and what isn't shared.
Exactly. They want to be told up front.
Right. Facebook has had for a while a feature where you could plug in somebody's name in your settings to see how they view your page.
That's kind of hidden if you don't look for it.
It is. It's hard to find. I'd agree. The other thing is that they don't really have a way to show what's exposed to the APIs and available to their advertisers, the games, and whatnot. They've added a couple settings over the years to turn that off and on, but they really don't tell you what they're sharing when it's on.
Exactly. There was Mark Zuckerberg demoed something just recently. They're supposedly adding that feature where you can open up the privacy control panel and it will tell you what stuff is viewable, what stuff is not. Like, it's supposed to be just what you said. So we'll see if that comes. But the one thing that I looked at, it's something that a lot of people don't even know is there. If you log into your account, you go to Privacy Settings, Applications and Websites, and that's the section where you give control over, like, what programs have access to your information, what other websites have access to your information. There's a new feature that they just threw in there without telling anybody called Instant Personalization Pilot Program. I don't know if any of you have ever seen, if you've ever gone to a website that implements this, there will be a Facebook bar at the top of the website, and it'll show your user account is logged in. It'll allow you to, you know, like this page and do Facebook things on a non-Facebook page. But it's a way to make any page, any website, integrated with Facebook. And they threw this in there without telling anybody. But the problem with this is it's on. By default, it is on. And that leads to advertisers, any website, anybody with access to this instant personalization API able to get not only your data, but any data that you can see. So, I mean, that's a huge deal that if, you know, if I don't want any of my, let's say, you know, I don't know, somebody's been stalking me. I made all of my stuff private. I don't want anybody other than my friends able to see my page. So I do that. I'm cool. It's all private. Now, let's say, you know, Ryan didn't realize that this instant personalization feature was there. You didn't turn it off. If you go to a web page that implements this, any of those advertisers or people with access to that can view your friends list and then view the info you can see on those friends. Right. So then they then can see my private information because you're a friend with me.
Right.
So, I mean, this is horrible.
Yeah, I guess there's the breakdown here, I think, between what Facebook has done and probably the collective consciousness is that, you know, we have the idea of, like, I want to tell somebody something, but I don't want them to tell that information to anyone else. If anyone's had a friend who's revealed a secret, they know that notion is pretty much bunk. But I still think the notion in the digital realm is valid. While I can't ensure that my friends won't give away my secrets, or, you know, maybe they're not secrets. It's just information, personal information that you don't want shared, like your address or your phone number. I don't think that there's any guarantee they won't give it away, but I think Facebook should be doing due diligence here, and not allowing a hole into your account such that your friends can share, anything about you. I just think that's not right.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you're right. Don't put anything on the internet that you don't want people to have. You know, that's just the rule you got to live by. But on the other side of the token, Facebook should not allow this to happen. And, you know, they cover themselves. They put in super, super fine print on that page. Please keep in mind that if you opt out, your friends may still share public Facebook information about you to personalize their experience on these partner sites unless you block this application. So this is in, like, 4-point font. You know, you're not going to see it. It's light gray.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's ever going to see this. So they do cover themselves by telling you this is happening, but unless you're looking for it, you're not going to know. And I think that's the biggest problem, is that people just don't know. This feature was turned on by default. They don't know they're exposing their friends' information. And nobody's going to care until all of a sudden they're getting junk mail in their real mailbox because they have their address online and that's being shared.
Well, I think as evidenced around here, and I don't know for any of the listeners, we're in the 12th district of 12th congressional district from Pennsylvania. There's been quite an uproar over the robocalls from the political campaigns, and that was for a special election for our congressman. People do not like an invasion of their privacy. They do not like it. They do not want phone calls. If they're on a do not call list, they do not want to be called. It's very evident, and I think that Facebook is probably going to have to correct the course here soon, or probably suffer some consequences from a regulating agency. You know, there'll be some sort of equivalent of a do not call list, in the digital age. And I don't know how that would take shape and who would regulate that. But, they definitely should think about these. I think this is evidence of the fact that Facebook is really sort of lost in their how they're going to go about doing business, because they're basically an advertising company, much like Google. But you know, the difference between Facebook and Google is that Google figured out how to pretty quickly make money from advertising and do it in such a way that doesn't invade people's privacy.
Right.
To the point that Facebook does, or could.
Yeah, I read a lot of commentary on Mark's article. His last point that he makes, he listed the principles under which Facebook operates. The last one is, we will always keep Facebook a free service for everyone. Well, how is he going to do that? He's going to have to start giving information to advertisers. There's going to have to be ads. I mean, that's the only way he's going to keep this free, so people don't have to pay for their account. So, I mean, that last point is evident that something is going to come soon as far as advertising is concerned on Facebook's site. So the last thing I wanted to talk about, I got 2 points on it, is the concept of net neutrality. I know a lot of people probably don't know what this is. For those of you who don't know, you're probably against it because of the TV commercials that you've seen recently run by some morons, I like to call them. There's one group called Americans for Prosperity, and they basically say, you know, sign this petition, tell the FCC we don't want you to regulate our internet. So, you know, they're all against it. But let me just lay some backing here. So, a year ago, maybe more than a year ago, it's still happening today. You know, companies like Comcast especially, they were the ones who got caught. They would throttle certain people using too much bandwidth. And if some people were using applications that they didn't deem fit for their network, such as peer-to-peer applications or any type of application where people can transfer large files like music or movies, they would not only throttle them, but they would cut their connection. They would send out these messages, packets, across the network called reset packets. And anytime your machine receives a reset packet, your machine knows, cut the connection, no questions asked. Whatever you're connected to gets lost. So Comcast was doing this to a lot of their customers who they deemed, you know, using too much traffic. So the FCC, and, you know, I don't like the FCC for a lot of things. You know, they regulate TV, you know, over-the-air TV. They tell you what you can and can't have on TV. I think that's crap. You know, I think their reasons are that, you know, kids shouldn't be able to turn on TV and see bad stuff. I think that's the parents' problem, not the government's, to do that. So, you know, that's one reason I hate the FCC. But in this case, the FCC is trying to do good. They're trying to find a way to make legislation such that they can punish companies like Comcast for doing this crap. You know, the way the telephone service works is that, you know, it's pretty much open. It's governed in such a way, I think it's Title II, either Title I or Title II. Do you know which one that is?
I don't. I'm not intimately familiar with the telecommunications code.
But. Okay, so yeah, it's the Telecommunications Act. There's a couple titles, and whichever one that the phone system is governed under means that no company can come in and change how it works. You know, they can't come in and say, oh, calls from this area code we're going to put through, calls from this area code we're going to, you know, make them ring 30 times before we allow somebody to pick up. You can't change the way it works. That's not the case for the internet. But the FCC is trying to push it so that is the case, so that companies who, you know, ran the lines underground, or ISPs, your internet service providers, can't come in and say, we're going to throttle you, we're going to let your traffic through, we don't want people browsing YouTube on our network because it takes up too much bandwidth. So the FCC is trying to put together some legislation to reclassify the internet, the network of cables, so that companies like Comcast can't do this. So that's the whole point of net neutrality, trying to keep it an open network so nobody can come in and screw with it and ruin your experience on the internet. So Comcast recently had a little win. You know, they took it to the courts, the FCC took them to the court, and the court ruled that FCC can't punish Comcast. They can't do anything about it. So the FCC appealed this, you know, of course, because for once in their life, they're trying to do something good. You know, so what do you think about this, Ryan, the whole net neutrality thing?
Well, I think your summary there, I mean, there are probably a lot of people out there that are, I'm definitely a libertarian. I think there's a lot of libertarians out there that believe that any type of regulation of businesses is a bad thing. And I disagree with your comment a little bit, Kevin, about the FCC is generally bad. or in the past has been bad, is basically the shape of telecommunications in the early part of the 20th century. Radio and TV were largely regulated by the FCC, and this was done because there's only so much bandwidth in the air. Okay, so you know, if we just talk about the airwaves in general, and I've got some air quotes going on there.
You got to be here to see the air quotes.
Yeah, the airwaves that you know that are available are limited, especially in the early part of the 20th century, when there's only certain types of radio technologies available. They basically set the stage in determining how people got licenses to broadcast. You know, managed the spectrum in different parts of the country. And they still continue to do that today. I mean, everybody's familiar probably with the digital TV transition that just recently happened. And that's actually impacted some other customers of that bandwidth. They sold off the 700 megahertz band to broadband providers. The point being that the FCC does do good in regulating. And I think this is a place, much like roads, that the government has a place in regulating the operation of. If, you know, for instance, if every state built a different type of road that required a certain type of tire to run on it, you know, it'd be pretty hard to crisscross the country in a car. You'd have to stop at the state line for each state and change to a different set of tires. I think the same is true of the broadcast standards, and I think the same is true of the internet. We want some regulation of those standards. And I think what this really boils down to is, you know, a company taking advantage of its position as both a telecommunications provider and a content provider. Everybody's familiar with the AOL Time Warner merger. You know, there's all these large mergers that happened and I think they've since split up. But the point being that content providers and system providers are one and the same. And it would have been very easy for Time Warner to say, well, we're going to give AOL customers a priority on our network, you know, so that our service benefits. Another example, and I don't know exactly. Well, I think Comcast recently, they're considering purchasing NBC.
Yeah.
Or yeah. Something like that, or one of the
somebody major, was. I remember hearing.
Yeah,
about that.
It was a large cable corporation. You know, something like that. They could preferentially give all of NBC.com's streaming bandwidth a preference for all of their Comcast customers, which is unfair.
Let me add something there for the people who don't realize it. Just because you don't have Comcast doesn't mean your internet access doesn't go across Comcast lines. So right. If you're trying to access something from Google, Google's in California, your web traffic might have to go through Comcast in Illinois or Comcast in Texas across their lines that they own before it gets to Google. So this is a problem for everybody, not just Comcast customers.
Yeah, I mean, it could affect everyone. I mean, I'm not sure how much fiber, you know, backbone fiber Comcast owns. They may lease a lot of it and lease it in whole such that they have complete control over what it's transmitted across it. The bigger problem are companies like Verizon. I mean, I like Verizon. I'm a big Verizon fan. But, hey, everyone knows they own a crap ton of fiber. You know, there's a company out on the West Coast called Quest. Quest owns a lot of fiber. These are all former Baby Bell companies that, you know, they did, you know, take the time and the money to invest in these networks. But I think it would be malicious for them to use their power as a provider to see that their subsidiary companies in a different market, such as content production, would get a benefit over other content productions. You know, we've got lots of companies that built roads, and they're not allowed to give preferential treatment to Toyotas or to Dodges.
Right. They can't put up different lines and say Toyotas have to wait 20 minutes before getting on this highway, whereas Dodges can get on right now.
Exactly. You know, and maybe the analogy is a little bit loose here, but I think by and large, what the FCC is trying to do with net neutrality specifically is a good thing. There are a lot of other things the FCC is trying to do in regulating the internet, and I think some of those are wrong. You know, they
can
may
you
be,
bring up a couple things that.
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, governing content, what can be on the internet versus can't be on the internet. I think that some of the things they're trying to do, they're trying to split up, I believe they're trying to split up content providers on the internet and the backbone providers, and classifying them differently in the telecommunications code. But I'm not exactly familiar with specific instances, but nonetheless, I think their power could be very easily abused in regulating what is on the internet. I mean, you know, nobody wants to see their favorite content go away. And, you know, depending on what they decide can and can't be on the internet, you know, they may even, it may come down to things like where we've in the U.S. have benefited from a very open interface to the internet. We can pretty much see any other country's content, but there are other countries where their content is blocked.
China.
Yeah, exactly. you know, so I don't think we want the FCC to be able to do those sort of things either. You know, the internet, I recently watched a interview of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs together. I can't remember the name of the
was it on YouTube or some?
Yeah, it was on YouTube.
Site?
It was on YouTube. I can't remember the name of the people that interviewed them, but nonetheless, anyways, Bill Gates had this quote, and he said that, you know, that this is not a quote, just a statement, that the internet and its open standards have provided for a huge, huge rise in the use of technology, and it's spread like wildfire in large part due to the internet. And I think he said basically right there, it's the open standards part of it that allowed that to happen. I would hate to see, you know, some of the way the things have been built on the internet, such as, you know, RFCs and those other things that that kind of built the backbone of all the protocols, to be, you know, wiped under the rug and we move on to this new regulated, you know, internet. I just think it'd be a bad thing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, those things, nobody wants that to happen. I don't want that to happen. That's the same thing I feel about, you know, over-regulating TV. You know, I don't want that to happen. But the one specific thing about them, you know, trying to reclassify the internet to punish companies like Comcast and make sure other companies can't do this, I think that's a good thing they're trying to do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, to make sure that no one's abusing, really what they're doing is it's a form of antitrust that they're trying to protect against.
Right. And that's the thing that Comcast is doing. You mentioned it. You know, they're only doing this because there is no punishment for it. You know, they're taking advantage of their situation of not being able to be punished for doing these things. So, you know, the FCC is coming in trying to make sure that, hey, we can punish you if you start screwing with people's, you know, open internet.
Yeah.
And just recently, because the FCC did that appeal, 73 Democrats in the Senate wrote a letter to the FCC telling them, stop appealing. We do not want you to do this. You know, so I don't know. I don't know where this goes, if the Senate or, you know, if any of Congress can change what happens, or if, you know, this is just going to get through to a higher court, you know, Supreme Court or whatever they make their whatever and it happens. I don't know if Congress has any say in any of this.
Just a question, Kevin. Is this the Senate or the House? Because there's only 59 Democrats in the Senate, or is it is it 73 senators, largely authored by Democrats?
It's 73 Democrats. I don't know if they're all in Congress or if it's just plain senators. But yeah, I know for sure it's 73 Democrats, but I don't know where they all live.
Okay.
Yeah, but either way, you know, I don't know what that is, you know, how that's going to affect anything. I don't know if they have any pull or if they're just saying, hey, if something does come down to the House and the Senate, we're going to vote against it, so don't even try.
Yeah. I think one thing that may help everyone is to break this down. I mean, really what it boils down to is the ISPs, the large ISPs such as Comcast, Verizon, and the rest of them, they're overselling bandwidth. That's the real problem here.
That's a huge problem.
They're doing the same thing that AT&T's doing in the mobile world. They're selling people a service they can't provide during peak hours. You know, the notion that a single person can take down an entire network is pretty far fetched. You know, these heavy users are not going to hog all of the bandwidth. That's impossible. If anyone's familiar with TCP/IP, there's a thing called end-to-end congestion control. You know, it uses a receive and transmit window that change sizes so that basically you can get the best connection performance, and all the computers on the network are constantly optimizing that receive and transmit window using
the routers take care of that automatically.
Well, yeah, I mean, it actually happens in the stack inside the OS. The routers have the ability to influence that. I can remember back to my college days, one of the guys that was in a class with me was studying TCP/IP, and he actually modified the TCP/IP stack in a Linux machine to remove the end-to-end congestion control. And he immediately brought down the lab network at my college. But that was, you know, a malicious thing. It's that can be prevented against. It's pretty easy for a router to detect the fact that all of the packets are going to one IP address, you know, and sort of look for that problem. So I don't believe that this is a problem of people hogging bandwidth as much as it is that they do not have that bandwidth to provide.
Right. And I just wanted to clarify the one thing that you said with overselling bandwidth. You know, all you out there who have internet connections, let's say, you know, you have DSL and you pay for 3 megabit downstream. You know, that's what you pay for. What that should mean is that you are able to 100% utilize 3 megabits 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's what that should mean, because you are paying for 3 megabits down. That's not at all what it means. If you do that, they will cancel your account yesterday. You know, they are saying, basically what they are saying is that you have 3 megabits at some times. If you use 3 megabits too much, we're going to either make you upgrade to a bigger plan or we're going to shut off your account. You know, so that's the whole problem with overselling bandwidth. What they say you get is not at all what you actually can use 100% of the time.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, you know, most of these providers have a clause in their terms of service. You know, any type of abuse can lead to termination.
And it's funny that using the bandwidth that you pay for is abuse.
Yeah, them. I agree. I think really what they need to do is be more realistic in their advertising. You
right.
know, if it's not really 3 megabit service, you know, advertise it as, you know, whatever, 512K service with a burst to 3 megabit. I think if they're more realistic in their advertising, though, the expectations will not be as high.
Right. And Comcast, funny that, you know, this is one thing that they're actually doing good. They do that in their service. You know, you can pay for 8 megabit, that would be awesome. 8 megabit cable with 30 megabit burst. Mm-hmm. You know, you pay a little bit extra for that burst, but, you know, they're still overselling that 8 megabits. If you use that full 8 megabits 100% of the time, they're going to call you up and talk to you.
Yeah.
But at least they're trying to tell you, you know, you could get this every once in a while. So I don't know. So Comcast is 99% bad, 1% good.
Yeah, I'd agree.
So anything else that you want to talk about? Anything cool you saw happen in the past couple weeks?
I don't have anything written down.
Yeah, I should have told you beforehand, you know, come prepared with stuff, but
yeah,
I didn't. I'm sorry. This is my first time with a guest. I don't know what I'm doing.
At
least,
do I.
You know, you can hear this. I printed out papers of the topic, so we at least know what we're doing.
Yeah, nice.
So anyways, that is the end of this show. You can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/slonkack, on Twitter at twitter.com/slonkack, and my personal website, kevinslonka.com. You can find Ryan at facebook.com/RyanLancey, twitter.com/RyanLancey, or his personal website, lancipedia.blogspot.com. Any other things you want to plug?
No, I think that's about it.
Okay, so we look forward to your comments on the webpage, and have a wonderful rest of your Memorial Day.